facing the backlash, the downfall, the fall of the American Empire, and how it is affecting us in all of these different ways.
Yeah.
And so as we go through this time, remember just to stay strong, define the joy in it, but always
fight.
And that's what, right. What you say?
Fight.
As our predecessors, John Lee Johnson used to say, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth, Aaron Ammons, and late John Lewis say, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Yeah, I hope I got into some good trouble earlier when I called in. A great show as usual, folks. I second that, Amir. And yeah, do a honk and wave if you're going to both events, or right, if you right. know if you got an errand to run, go by the Champaign County on Main Street pavilion and honk your horn and give some solidarity. It's not going to be a real favorable day for a rally outside. I mentioned as I called in that Pacifica is covering the rallies across the country. And in fact, I just heard that Cope Cumpston is having a 3 o'clock intervention with Pacifica. She's going to report from the rally here. She does the catch the beat on Market Street on Wednesdays. And had Indivisible on a panel. I need to go back and collect that one in. I got a Zoom on Wednesdays, I think, that conflicts a little bit. So, underwriting announcement? What was the last one you did, man?
I did Fire Doll.
Okay, well, let's see if I can get close to following on in sequence here. It's always a good idea to keep the mentions out there. And let's see. Yeah, that would be Tanner Friedman.
Yeah.
Cheers. And, okay, I'll do a rundown right after this of what I got else today. Got to go to some Chris Hedges, I think, talking with the most hated man in Israel. Not a Palestinian, but a columnist for the Haaretz, which publishes more critical things of Israel than the New York Times does, and actually featured a piece on Beirut's Tabrizi Gamari. I think I reversed the surnames there. I've got a segment from him, too, today. I've been playing some things. He's been really busy. We were hoping to have a Public Eye article, but it won't be in the next issue. Though, we will have an update on CU Reparations activities, CU Reparations Committee, coalition.org, I guess it is. And so that is upcoming. So you can contact information there to find out how to join in the hashtag reparations now. And as I always like to say, I think reparations should be broadened, not just obviously to African-American workers and people that have had their labor deprived by chattel slavery, and after that Jim Crow, but also the victims of all colors and ethnicities of capitalism. But that's a broader story. I've reprised that a couple of times. I'm getting positive feedback from Aaron, and that always helps. Okay, here's an underwriting announcement.
Programming on WEFT is made possible in part by Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. Tanner Friedman is a public relations agency with a focus on media relations, crisis communications, and brand messaging. They also possess capabilities in video production, web design, and event promotion. More information on the firm and its work is at tannerfriedman.com.
So, I mentioned the coverage by Pacifica as a network and the 3 o'clock call-in from here by Cope Cumpston. Also, live stream. If you're shut in, not feeling like you want to brave the weather, after you do your honk and wave, maybe, not at the same time, please, check out the feed from the rally and see what kind of things are being discussed. It's all being documented, so I won't be down there with my tripod and video camera. I'm glad they're doing that with a good sound system from a musical group. And let's see. There we go. Mumi Abu-Jamal. He's got a commentary that hits him close to where he lives. I imagine in this incarceral state that the U.S. is, how it must feel to hear the judicial arguments that he's referring to. I said I'd do the rundown, as well as Chris Hedges with Gideon Levy at the very end. I want to put up something with, Becker? I can't remember his first name. He'll be introduced by Flashpoint's Dennis Bernstein. And he's with the Answer Coalition. And in the course of the interview that I won't be airing, I learned that that goes all the way back to Ramsey Clark, who was Attorney General on LBJ and came a long way from that position to be out on the dikes in North Vietnam preventing the war crime of attacking infrastructure like what feeds the country. But they went ahead and did it. But, yeah, so there's a long legacy to the Answer Coalition. And so that's another short segment. Talking about No Kings and the activities and the way the coalition is shaping up, more international subjects being treated. My signs, if I get them together, are no kings, no shahs, no mullahs, no autocrats. So hopefully I will have a moment of contemplation to steady my hand, and I'm not a graphic artist. Law and Disorder with Beirut, and that looks like it's running short. So I won't be editing that on the fly. I'll be editing it, period. Something happened in my transcription. So, Antoni Juaz is the only person I didn't mention, and this is a web exclusive from some time ago. But Oil Change International was the group she was with a while back. She talks about this sanctions war and predated the actual war. I mean, the blockade of oil to Cuba is an outright act of war. The blockade, general blockade, and Hill's act is against the international law as well, and it constantly gets voted down at the General Assembly. Nothing has ever happened from action from that. So anyway, that's kind of the rundown. Looping back to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Important voice in the mix, it seems to me. That's why I air him when I can. And he's got another one that's kind of cryptic. I have to do some research. I think he's hailing a legal case in Germany. He has a following around Europe in a big way, a cause célèbre, if you will. But here's his commentary about a legal case in, I guess, the state of Pennsylvania. Since I don't think the Supremes, or I call them the Extreme Court, are going to do anything about the death penalty in any near term.
Hey, listen, I want to salute all of you guys and gals at ALC, the Abolitionist Law Center, for an incredible win before the state Supreme Court. You know, as I told some of you, they piped oral arguments through most of the jails in Pennsylvania. Now, I'm partial and I'm biased as hell. So I thought you guys did an incredible job. But, you know, of course, over the months, guys have been like chewing on my ear, giving me their other reason why it would never happen. You know, you guys made it happen. And I've heard news already when I was doing my job earlier this afternoon. I congratulate all of you for an incredible piece of work with Derek Lee. Well done. Well done. Love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thank you. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
I can imagine hearing these inmates hearing this case. Obviously, they're not all in death row, but it affects people probably that they deal with. I didn't do a disclaimer. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others here at the station. Find out by asking. Let's go to the No King segment with Mr. Becker, who will be introduced. I wanted to mention there's also an event at the Unitarian Universalist Church. There'll be a screening of a film called Witness Palestine, including, I think you can go to the UU's page and learn some more information about that. The director of the film, Linda Mansour, is in town for this, so that's something I'm hoping I can get recorded and maybe present tomorrow. It's another grim part of the grimness of the world, but bringing some attention to it while everything else is competing for headlines in its grimness. And well, that's enough, I guess. This is about the No Kings rallies across the country. It has some figures in it about how many rallies, and et cetera. We heard that earlier with the local organizer. And yeah.
His partner now, I think, is still in Cuba, wrestling making sure that they don't lose the island as Trump is trying to organize a real takedown. Richard Becker, welcome to Flashpoints. Tell us about, it's been a long time coming. Are you excited? Do you see the No Kings movement as viable? You're somebody who's been in the movement for many decades. How do you look at it now?
Well, I think that we're at a very interesting moment, and it'll be super interesting to see the turnout tomorrow. The last I heard, it was over 3,300 cities and towns where demonstrations are taking place. And, you know, I think about, like, how has this developed? And the first one of the No Kings Day, I think, was in June, wasn't it? Something
yes.
like that?
Yes, it was.
And then there was one in October. And the one in June... There was, by the organizers, didn't want to have any international issues involved. And I think there's been a struggle that's gone on over this about where now the international, the struggle against war in particular is there. It's there in the publicity. I think it's there in the consciousness of many people, many of the people who started out, you know, thinking only of the domestic situation here. Now, I think, have come to see that these are very much connected, that the international struggles, the anti-war movement, the anti-intervention movement is integrally tied to the domestic struggles, and that it's impossible to really see success in the struggles around free speech and benefits and rights that people have won that Trump's trying to take away. It's impossible to see that being that movement being victorious without having an understanding of the connection between the war machine and the struggle to crush countries like Iran and Cuba and Venezuela and others. And so I find it very encouraging because, you know, in a way it becomes more like a matter of class, kind of class consciousness, that like we see the other side is not our friend in any respect. They are the enemy. And we have to build the kind of movement of millions, and we're certainly hoping that the prediction that there'll be 12 million or 15 million tomorrow, that comes true. But the other thing I would say about it is that a year ago, there was a lot of dismalness, and I don't think the dismalness is there anymore. I think people are worried, but I think the people who are still talking gloom and doom, you know, are not paying attention to what's happening here. We're a long way from winning. There are many struggles, but I think that we can see that the movement against Trump and the Trump program, the billionaire program, because it's not just Trump, of course, that movement is going forward, and that it has the, because of the steadfastness of people who have been in it from the beginning, It's emerging, and one way you can see that it really is emerging is the splits that are happening within the Trump camp, of which there are many and numerous, including, of course, many of the base who thought that Trump was serious about not going to war and was serious about bringing down the price of things and the affordability and all of that. So I think a lot of people are jumping that ship. They I think it was the weakness of Biden more than anything that propelled them toward the, not everyone, but a lot of people who were in the middle, really. And now they have, I think they're very much moving away from Trump.
Let me ask you, Dick, because you are a student, a longtime student of foreign policy. I want to ask you, give us with some clarity, the role you see Israel playing in the context of this unfolding war, what's going on now. We know that American politicians, the leading American politicians, are absolutely owned by the Israeli lobby. So how does this cloud the movement and undermine the struggle?
Yeah, and that, I'm glad you raised that, because I think that is very important, that, you know, especially for the younger demographics, meaning people basically up to the age of 40, there's been a tectonic shift in the view toward Israel and the Palestinian struggle. That's a very big one. There still is, of course, a strong element among the ruling elite who are very much for Israel, who see Israel as essential to U.S. foreign policy aims, particularly in the Middle East. The Israelis, I think, are looking at this as an opportunity. You know, this is the sixth invasion since 1978, the sixth Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I mean, so you sort of get the picture of why they're doing it. They intend to keep it. This is part of the expansion of the State of Israel that has been desired since the State of Israel was founded by its founders back in 1948. They always have considered the 1948 borders to be inadequate. They've basically taken over most of the West Bank. They've taken over the Golan Heights, very rich land, which is often brought up. And now they've expanded that. And now that big symbol, the way you know what they intend to do, is they blew up the main bridge. They blew up a number of bridges between the south of Lebanon over the Litani River, with the intention, I think, clearly the intention, that's very beautiful country, very fertile country, that they intend to keep it. So we have that happening, any of the people here, the political leaders here who keep defending the State of Israel, are going to become known for the bankruptcy of their views and of the positions that they're taking. And that includes Gavin Newsom, who just withdrew his statement that Israel was an apartheid society, which of course it is.
Absolutely, Richard. But one of the things that I've noticed in this whole thing, and of course here in California and other parts of the country, they have actually passed legislation or resolutions that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. You know, and I think that's the basis that they all operate from. But aside from that, I've also have recently seen, as of in the last few days, where the Israeli military commanders are all of a sudden saying, hey, we're depleted, we're running out of ammunition, we're running out of arms. Well, you know, for the last 2 years, they've been basically daily bombardment, you know, of Gaza, of Palestine. And now we see the government ready to throw another $2 billion into this conflict. It seems to be expanding and getting ready for what we call a forever war. What can people do, Richard, at this point? I know tomorrow's going to be, you know, no King's Day, but as you said, there's been some eternal struggles within those organizations to finally say no war. You know, the war, the illegal war, the unconstitutional war needs to come. Well, how do you see this? Where do people need to be?
Well, I think anyone who's paying attention to the military and the so-called defense budget, it really is a war budget, of course, that in addition to the about $1 trillion this year, a little bit under $1 trillion officially, but if you add in a number of other pieces of the puzzle, it's over $1 trillion. Now they're saying $1.5 trillion for next year, $200 billion more for the Iran war alone. That's $1.7 trillion. If you're wondering where the resources of society are going, I think that's very relevant. And no one can ignore this anymore. I mean, it can try. And you have the the leaders who are people who are running around in the media and the universities and so forth and saying that any criticism of the state of Israel or what the U.S. does with Israel is anti-Semitism. We just have to stand up to that and say, you know, no, we're not anti-Semitic. We're a movement that includes people of many nationalities, all kinds of ethnic groups and religions, and that's just trying to hide the reality of what's going on. The genocide that continues to go on, the expulsion of the Palestinians that continues to go on. So we have to just stand up to all of this stuff. We just, and I think if we do, we will win. If we can, you know, have that steadfastness that the Palestinians have talked about, using the word sumud, meaning steadfast, we can be victorious. And, you know, I think that we will be.
Of Richard Becker, ANSA Coalition, major organizer here in the Bay Area and around the country. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilo Molina. And Richard, can you stay with us?
Richard Becker was his name. I do a better job of announcing that event. It's actually evening. I thought it was right after the No Kings rally. But Nancy Mansour, Palestinian-American Executive Director of Eyewitness Palestine, will be at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Green Street. Middle Eastern food and socializing at 6:30. Presentation begins at 7. And I thought there was a film involved, but there's no mention of that here. So I guess it's a talk by Nancy Mansour. Again, 6:30 to 8:30 is Saturday night. Okay. I think I'll go to Antonia Juhas next. This is from first week of the war, but I don't think it's particularly dated. And there's some stuff in here about petroleum deals between the Chinese and the major players in the... are they U.S. corporations? I was thinking they're called transnational corporations. They're called A-national, as in not national corporations. They actually have joint development with the Chinese government. I didn't know that. Then Behrouz Ghamari reprised some of that, and like I said, that might be an abrupt edit because. Didn't transcribe the way I thought it did. So here's from Amy Goodman earlier in the week, but this is part two, so it hasn't been aired. This is one of those web exclusives. They had a very short interview with her and felt like they should go back and talk some more. Even talks about AI and petrochemicals. So, yeah. Of course, Not particularly an environmentalist, but Elon Musk wants to have them orbiting in space, so they would be solar powered, I guess. There's already too much crap up there, particularly from his generation. But that's another opinion that is mine and not necessarily shared by others at the station. Here's Amy and Juan with Antonia Juhas. Used to be with Oil Change International, which I really think is a great name, but she's with another group now.
War and Oil with Antonia Juhas, independent investigative journalist, regular Rolling Stone politics reporter, author of several books on the fossil fuel industry, including The Bush Agenda and The Tyranny of Oil. I want to begin this continuation of our discussion by playing you a clip of the well-known war hawk, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, being interviewed on Fox News over the weekend.
Yeah. Venezuela and Iran have 31% of the world's oil reserves. Yep. We're going to have a partnership with 31% of the known reserves. This is China's nightmare. Yep. This is a good investment, and we should applaud our men and women in the military who are doing something I've never seen done before, decimating a brutal enemy in 9 days.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham. Antonia Juhas says he responds to oil for wars for oil from Venezuela to Iran. If you can lay out oil geopolitics and what is actually happening here.
Yeah, I mean, let's remember that after Iraq, Iran was always next on the Bush administration's agenda for war. Bush was building up to a second wave of the war in Iran for years and planning for it and meaning to go forth with it. But then the Iraq war was so disastrous, and particularly the public was so done with war and done with that war and certainly had no stomach for a second front, that the Republicans could not move on into Iran. And the war probably cost the Republicans the presidency. U.S. oil interests lobbied aggressively to pursue oil on their terms in Iraq and Iran, driving the invasion of Iraq, lobbying aggressively to see a second front in the war in Iran. As I have, you know, written repeatedly about war in the Middle East, oil is a key agenda. But of course, driving a country like the United States to war is never a simple thing, and it's never just one thing. And of course, Israel and the interests of Israel go side by side with that agenda. It's how do the pressures that want to see a military invasion take place get that invasion to go? It's meeting a series of interests by a series of players. That's certainly oil and oil companies, not necessarily securing oil wealth, quote unquote, for the United States, but securing oil wealth for oil companies has driven the wars in Iraq, has driven a war in Iran, and certainly helped drive the war in Venezuela, where Trump has now, literally said, we're going to take the oil. What has happened in Venezuela is actually sort of fascinating, and you can somewhat understand, based on Trump's, you know, I guess, limited worldview of how he can accomplish the things he wants for himself and the people who support him and whose interests he's trying to support, thought perhaps that because Venezuela worked easily for him, that Iran would work similarly. And one of the ways that Venezuela worked easily was that all Trump cared about was getting in a pliable government. And that's what he has said he also wants in Iran. And pliable means a lot of things, including when the U.S. invaded Iraq, one of the goals was getting the Iraqis to change their national oil law to essentially privatize the industry, not totally, but sort of. The Iraqis wouldn't go along with it. U.S. oil companies got the type of contracts that they want, and they got into Iraq, so they did okay. But in Venezuela, right after Trump removed the president of Venezuela, within 2 weeks' time, the Venezuelans implemented a very similar new national oil law. And one of the reasons why that happened was after Trump removed the president of Venezuela, he had that now historic gathering of oil company executives at the White House. A lot of press was paid to one word that Darren Woods, the CEO of ExxonMobil, said, that Venezuela is uninvestable. What got a lot less attention was the words that followed that, which he said, but we think it would be fine if we can get the terms that we want. And one of those key terms we want is a new national oil law in Venezuela. And the Venezuelans quickly agreed and put in place a new law. And now U.S. oil companies are lining up and getting ready. Some are already in and signing deals and increasing production in Venezuela because they were able to get what they wanted on their own terms. The idea that Iran could be that simple is, frankly, ludicrous. But you could see that perhaps the Trump folks persuaded by Netanyahu to go to war felt that perhaps this is something they could also accomplish. And I think Trump still thinks he can accomplish. I think he is obviously speaking with Putin. Putin has influence over the Iranians. Perhaps they're figuring out some sort of deal. Because what Trump clearly underestimated was the power that the Iranians have and how that is so significantly different from the Venezuelans. And part of that is, of course, their control within the region, not only, their military, but their control within the region and their ability to control not just their own significant oil reserves, but the reserves of almost the entire region and what the impact of that would mean globally. I think the Trump administration mostly didn't care and thought that it could weather whatever these harms might be, but I'm not sure that that is going to be the case that plays out.
Antonia Yuhas, again, this is from a bit ago, but the analysis stands, it seems to me. One thing that I haven't heard anywhere, and maybe I missed it on Amy Goodman's show, but the reason why the oil change agreement was able to be done so quickly was it was already on the table. Maduro was considering it. He was getting criticism from left-wingers like Tariq Ali for actually wanting to go ahead and reprivatize and letting the oil the transnationals in. So the thing was already in the table. Trump likes having the totem of capturing Maduro and killing some Cuban guards or something. It's a good take for him in some locales, but it was already going to it could have happened with Maduro still in power. And it seems to me the case in New York, as illustrated, a 90-year-old judge who seems to be pretty quick-witted made Maduro smile at the end of the session, is not going to take the baloney that they're offering. They're going to he's going to have a real defense. And I noticed that they kept the guns charges, weapons charges. They're charging him with weapons violations that are U.S. weapons rules, laws. It's absurd. I mean, in a different country, the whole thing could be just a house of cards, unless I don't know. But anyway, that's my addendum that I haven't heard anywhere, and I should write it up, I guess. But I did get it out here again. Going to go return to this segment, and we will have more on. From Gideon Levy about the manipulation by Bibi and his crew. Not that he needed a lot, I suppose.
Antonio, I wanted to ask you about something that's not directly connected to oil, but is certainly influenced by it or energy, which is that the Middle East has also emerged, especially the Gulf states, as a major center of the developing worldwide artificial intelligence infrastructure. In December, the State Department issued what they call Pax Silica, which was supposedly a declaration by 11 countries, mostly in the Gulf states, but also including Israel, that they were coordinating the development of artificial intelligence infrastructure. And most people are not aware that Saudi Arabia is home to 61 data centers and the UAE to 57 data centers. So this whole region has emerged as a major center for the build out of artificial intelligence infrastructure. And the Iranians, knowing that, targeted several data centers in their attacks, sort of sending a signal to the worldwide investment community that there is another weakness in the chain of imperial domination, which is not just oil, but also their artificial intelligence buildup. I'm wondering your thoughts about that.
No, I mean, I think that's very interesting. I think obviously artificial intelligence takes an enormous amount of fossil fuel. So it's not surprising that you see these two, interests align. It takes an enormous quantity of fossil fuels, fossil fuel power, fossil fuel energy to power these data centers. And they are, they go hand in hand. The fossil fuel industry has also, by the way, I think, used belief in the necessity of the vast expansion of data centers as a justification for its continued existence. If it can convince the world that it needs all of these data centers and it can convince the world that it needs the power to keep them going and that fossil fuels have yet another reason to continue on, when we know that in most other circumstances, we have excellent ways of moving past fossil fuels entirely to more sustainable, significantly less frail and fragile systems that fossil fuels clearly offer. So I think it's not surprising that these two power bases are being built up side by side, but also present another weakness, a weakness that the Iranians are taking advantage of in their retaliation. Sure. So there's been significant sanctions placed on Iranian oil, sanctions that the U.S. oil industry has been anxious to see removed. And if not the sanctions removed, then the regime removed so that U.S. oil companies could get in and start taking advantage of Iranian oil. But the only nation that currently is able to primarily receive Iranian oil is the Chinese. I honestly think the removing oil from the Chinese is certainly probably an interest of some people who have backed the war, but I don't believe it to be a real dominant interest. Because let me just give one example. In Venezuela, for example, one of the key benefits of removing Maduro for ExxonMobil and Chevron was that Maduro was blocking their biggest pot of oil, one of their biggest pots of oil in the world, which is in Guyana, waters that Venezuela claims as its own. Exxon and Chevron are developing, and it's a critically important pot of oil for them. And Maduro had literally gone after that oil with warships and trying to claim that oil as his. And now he's gone, and that area is now presumably going to be opened up. Well, guess who they're partnering with in that big pot of oil in Guyana? The Chinese. The Chinese are their primary partner. U.S. oil companies partner with Chinese oil companies all the time, all over the world. They're not in competition with the Chinese. They are literally partnering with the Chinese. Trump said when he went to Venezuela, you know, one of the things he was going to do was start selling the oil, and he was ready to sell it to the Chinese and sell it to the Russians. Trump has clearly aligned himself with Putin, and one of the key elements of their alliance is the dedication to a continued fossil fueled economy. So Trump has relieved sanctions on Russia already to make sure that its oil can continue to flow, because sanctions placed on Russia as a result of the invasion of Ukraine to try and lessen its ability to fund its war machine have been succeeding. They have weakened the economic wherewithal of the Russians. Of course, it's important to say the people who suffer the most from sanctions are the people of Russia, because the economic cost gets most aggressively placed on them. But it is also taking its toll on the Russian budget to continue to fund its continued war against Ukraine. So it is very good for Russia to come up with a deal with Trump that alleviates those sanctions, which is a key goal. And Trump actually said yesterday, first he said these are short-term relief on those sanctions. Then he said, but maybe there'll be so much peace that the sanctions can be removed altogether. That's what he said. So he's obviously talking with Putin about how to try and bring an end to this conflict in whatever way works best for the two of them. And then, of course, with Netanyahu. And so who knows what that's going to look like? Nothing good, I would imagine. So what I think is that the bottom line for Trump and Putin, and also I would add Mohammed bin Salman into this threesome of power of Saudi Arabia, is a world that remains committed to fossil fuels. And that is clearly an interest that aligns these three governments. The Iranians know this, and they are using that as a tool to go right at the heart of that fossil fuel reliance. And again, this shows just the weakness of fossil fuel dependence, because fossil fuels are concentrated. They're very easy to attack. They're very frail. They are sensitive to things like weather, instability, wars. And you can go after them and also cause great harm to people, the environment, and the climate as a result. They're also, as we've seen with oil markets, again, very, very volatile. The movement, the extreme movements in the price of oil shows that the price of oil is set not really by supply and demand, because right now there hasn't been a significant reduction in actual supply. To certain places there have been, but not globally. And the market is responding to an expectation of future supply loss. And that's why we're seeing the price go up and down so rapidly. Well, those up and downs have real impacts on real people's lives. So the price of gasoline has also skyrocketed with that price of oil. And that is impacting consumers in the United States who are already suffering from rising electricity costs that are also the result of the Trump administration's rejection of renewables, the adoption of data centers that need more energy, Juan, as you've indicated, and now a war that is causing gas prices to spike dramatically. And that impacts real people. Of course, a rise in the price of gas is nothing compared to the death and destruction that's happening to Iranians across the Middle East. But it's a real price that, again, is being borne because of the way that fossil fuels are so easily manipulated and so easily used as bludgeons of war and are the chosen tool of autocrats everywhere.
And Antonia, war itself, in terms of this, the long-term view of humanity's efforts to reduce its the planet's reliance on fossil fuels, every time one of these war mobilizations occurs, especially by the United States, all these ships sent to a region, all these planes moved and constantly attacking the need to replenish ammunition supplies. What does this say in terms of the ability to control or to reduce the climate catastrophe we face?
Yeah, of course, there's an enormous climate toll just of the functioning of militaries in their regular operations. And of course, as you say, you know, this mass mobilization causes you know, significant use of fossil fuels and release of climate destroying pollution. And, you know, we saw that quite visually on display again with these attacks by the Israelis backed by the Americans of the oil depots in Tehran, releasing those toxic clouds of smoke. People in Iran reported night, the day turning to night because the clouds were so thick. And then, as I said, the rain then pouring through those clouds, bringing the acid toxic rain. Those are also climate destroying chemicals being released into the air, and significantly more intensely when it's burned. As we all know, the Trump administration has worked aggressively to eliminate as much as possible the tools that have been put in place over decades to combat the worsening climate crisis, and of course to remove the tools for renewable energy. The big beautiful bill, as it's known, solidified a lot of that work by the Trump administration and by the fossil fuel industry to remove regulations and legal tools that have been used to reduce their pollution, both their immediate human health causing pollution and also their climate causing pollution. So members of the Trump administration are repeating almost word for word, actually, justifications that were used, explanations that were used by the first Bush in the first Iraq War, H.W. Bush, and also by the second Bush administration, where they stated one of the things we're trying to do is remove the power that control over fossil fuels gives our enemies. And the Trump administration is saying the same thing. Well, that power, that ability to abuse power from fossil fuels is also being wielded by the Trump administration. Trump continually reiterates, you know, now the United States produces enough oil and gas that we don't have to worry about changes in supply coming from around the world. So our production of fossil fuels is a power that we have. But that power is just as weak as it was in the 70s when the United States was more reliant on imports and the Arab-Israeli war and the nationalizations of oil in Iran caused great harm in the United States, including lines for gasoline. Well, now we don't have to worry necessarily about supply, although I will say that ExxonMobil has just shipped a significant amount of refined gasoline from the U.S. Gulf Coast to Australia because they have a contract with the Australians and they can't get their product out of the Middle East to Australia, so they're shipping it from the United States to Australia. So if we see more of that, we could see issues related to supply. But even if we have that supply, we're still reliant on a global price of oil that impacts the price of gasoline and could have the same effect. If people are priced out of being able to purchase gasoline or home heating, then it's the same effect of an actual reduction and reliance on supply. So that power gets wielded primarily against people who are the weakest, you know, in society, but also against governments that think it's going to be a tool that's going to strengthen them, but can also expose a tremendous weakness. And then, of course, the costs of a worsening climate are borne by absolutely everybody.
Antonia Yuhas, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Independent investigative journalist, regular Rolling Stone politics reporter, author of several books, including The Bush Agenda and The Tyranny of Oil. To see part one of our discussion with Antonia, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And that was from a couple weeks ago, but I said it had some stuff that I hadn't remembered. Iran was on the Bush agenda, but the fiasco of Iraq postponed it to a later date, which we're experiencing now. I see there's only 15 minutes left, so I guess I'll probably be playing more of the Gideon Levy tomorrow. Everything conspires against me. So we're going to hear what we can of Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi. Again, he was on campus a couple of weeks ago now, has this compilation book, some new writing, some older essays. He'll be well introduced by the people at Law and Disorder. Such a great name for the title. I guess the Houthis have started firing missiles into Israel now, too. So that was a shoe that was possibly going to drop and it has. So escalation trap is perhaps spinning out of control. So, yeah, this will probably, actually, I probably won't get any of Gideon Levy on. Maybe I'll reprise some of the announcements, including the Unitarian Universalist Church's event with Linda Mansour, Eyewitness Palestine, this evening. Many events today. Again, I guess maybe I'll reprise the fact that Pacifica Network is covering demonstrations across the country, including they'll be getting a call in from Cope Cumston, local producer in town here at WEFT. And so, yeah, it's live streamed as well. If you're not feeling comfortable while going out, honk and wave if you can't, if you can. But it's bracing, but after the 80 degrees we have, I guess maybe it feels cold to some people. Yeah, here's what we can play of the interview with Behrouz. It's about a half hour long, but obviously we're going to hear the first part of it. Has the anecdote about his escaping death row in Tehran and then escaping jail because of his cancer, that he needed to be out of the country for treatment. Pretty amazing story.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The war the United States and Israel started against Iran has been going on now since the last day of February. It'll end, Trump says, quote, when I feel it in my bones. For the USA's part, Trump wants regime change and a weak client state. He had hoped that assassinating Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, as well as many others in the top tiers of the Iranian government, would accomplish this. It did not. The Iranian people are protecting their sovereignty against an illegal war, the greatest of all crimes, which already has killed 2,000 people and destroyed much of the infrastructure of their country. 23 years ago, President George W. Bush falsely alleged that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and he attacked that country in violation of the United Nations Charter. The Israeli-American war against Iran was initiated by the same sort of fraud, alleging that Iran was on the brink of developing nuclear weapons and missiles to be able to send them all the way to the USA. The day before the war was initiated, the International Atomic Energy Agency concluded that Iran did not have and was not trying to develop a nuclear bomb. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has falsely accused Iran of being on the edge of developing nuclear weapons for the last 30 years now. Although the United States would like to reduce Iran to a weak client state, the Israeli government would like to make Iran into a failed state. Are we on the verge of World War III? We don't know. Iran is achieving successes against the military might of the United States in the region and does not want a ceasefire, although none has been offered, because they want to make sure that this never happens to them again. We speak today with Professor Behrouz Garmari, whose book, The Long War Against Iran, New Events, Old Questions, has just been published by Orr Books. He's affiliated with the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of Toronto, and before that, he was a professor and chair of the Department of Middle Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Although he's not a supporter of the politics of the current clerical regime, he is a defender of Iran's sovereignty. Professor Behrouz Garmari, welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, we're very, very proud to have you on our show. Behrouz, you write at the start of your book about being a death row prisoner in Iran, suffering from untreated terminal cancer, awaiting execution. Tell us about how you escaped this fate and became a prominent authority on the history and politics of Iran.
Okay, again, many thanks for this invitation. I was arrested in 1981 during the early periods after the revolution known as the Reign of Terror, which came after a sort of 2 years of relative ease and freedom in Iranian society, but then as the state went through consolidating its power, this power struggle between different groups intensified, and the government started arresting people. And others, particularly one group, the Mujahideen Khalq, or MEK, they started assassinating members of the ruling party. And I give you just one example, that in one night, on June 28, 1981, they planted a bomb in the headquarters of the ruling party, the Islamic Republic Party, and they killed 85 members of the leadership of the party in one night, including the head of the judiciary and the members of the parliament. And then they assassinated the president and the prime minister. And in return, the government started arresting all the known opposition figures, a mass execution of many people. And I was arrested during that time, sentenced to death. But the sentence was not ratified by the Supreme Court. I awaited carrying out my death sentence for almost 3 years, during which I developed cancer. And so to speak, I was on double death row, and they refused treatment. And until I was in a terminal stage, they gave me a medical parole. And then miraculously, you know, I was cured of cancer and came to the U.S. As part of the treatment, and survived a terminal condition. And so in a sense, I was on double death row, but cancer saved my life. You know?
Goodness, my goodness. Well, Barus, please talk to us a bit about the history of U.S. interventions in that region of the world.
No, in many different ways, the Iranian Revolution of 1979 was a reaction to U.S. CIA and MI6-sponsored coup in 1953 that toppled the Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who came to the office of Prime Minister with a program of nationalizing the Iranian oil industry. This is at the time there are all these different kinds of liberation independent movements around the world against the French and British Empire. And that was the Iranian version of, although Iran was not formally colonized, but it was part of the sphere of influence of the British and the Russian Empire before the Russian Revolution. At the time, Iranian oil was controlled by the British oil company, Persian British Oil Company. And the contract that existed at the time gave Iran around 15 to 16% of the profit, and 85-86% of the profit to the British. So it was a very extremely colonial contract. And when Iran intended to nationalize the oil, the British first tried to recruit the Americans to help them to reclaim their position in Iran, first through Truman administration and then Eisenhower administration. Truman was a little bit lukewarm towards this project, but Eisenhower was full in, helping to overthrow the government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 53. Oil obviously was not the only thing that they were concerned with, but also they wanted to establish and contain the possible expansion of the Soviets in the Iranian territories. This was a policy, the Cold War policy, that they instituted everywhere around the world. Iran was no exception, and in all these years from 1950s to the collapse of the Soviet Union, the American policy that intervention was guided by helping to create tyrannical regimes that could guarantee the suppression of leftist movements in different countries around the world and contain the expansion of the Soviet Union influence. So for 25 years, from 1953 to 1978-79, in the Iranian political lexicon, that's known as the dark years of tyranny. And the U.S., for all practical purposes, turned Iran into a client state in the region. The Shah of Iran was known as the policeman of the Middle East. Iran developed a very strong military that was the fifth largest military in the world and number one consumer of American arms. So when the Iranian Revolution happened, you can imagine what kind of deep wound it generated for American interests in the region. So from that point on, the U.S. was a mission to contain Iranian revolution and in so many different ways to go back to the map of the Middle East before the 1979 revolution. The U.S. helped Saddam Hussein during its war, 8-year war between Iran and Iraq. Saddam Hussein was helped by the Soviets, by the Americans, by the Germans, by the French, by the British. The U.S. particularly supplied Saddam Hussein with satellite images, intelligence, and helicopters. Iraqis used chemical weapons against Iran, and those chemical weapons were supplied to the Iraqis by the Germans and the means of delivery by the U.S. And then, you know, that in so many different ways, the U.S., through imposing sanctions, most draconian sanctions, the sanctions against Iran is exceptional throughout the world, that how crippling these sanctions are. The ultimate goal of the U.S. is to either force the Iranian government to submit to U.S. demands or a regime change and reestablishing an state whose policies are consistent with U.S. interest in the region.
Baruch, despite the repressive politics of the state, Iran has remained a vibrant society with active intellectual, cultural, and social justice movements. Can you please talk about this? After all, the conventional image of Iran here in America is that it's a totalitarian society run by religious fanatics.
Yeah, that's an important question, because this is often not the image we get about Iranian society and the Iranian state in Western media, and that's not the hegemonic narrative through which we understand that society. But for the past 40 years or so, particularly after the end of Iran-Iraq War in 1989, from 1989 to present, there has been so many different forms of social movements, building civil society institutions, women's movements, intellectual circles, student movements, publishing business in Iran, which had flourished tremendously. And every step of the way, there was two steps forward, one step back because of the state reaction. But if you compare Iranian society in 2025, at least before this past few months, to the Iranian society of the early 1990s, you see a significant difference in terms of how vibrant civil society had become, again, despite the pressures by the government and despite some retreat from some of the gains that people have made. In my own work, I try to highlight these gains, and as a response to people who are defending U.S. intervention in Iran and this war, those people who say that, well, Iranians tried everything, nothing worked, and the only alternative now remained was a war to basically overthrow the regime. This couldn't be farther than the truth. Iranian society has gained so much, and that space of social movement and the struggle inside the country remained extremely vibrant. And again, I don't say this to draw a rosy picture of Iranian society and this state, but I want to draw your attention, our listeners' attention, to the fact this state has shown throughout the past three decades or so, while it is very aggressive in maintaining its dominance in society through coercive forces, but it has never been successful in generating a totalitarian society, a totalitarian in a sense that they could control all aspects of social life. They have authoritarian policies, but they failed to create a totalitarian society because...
Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi from the original Law and Disorder. You can find the rest of that. He's been on a number of times. I've replayed him. He was in town, too, giving a talk, which I couldn't record because everything is so heated. He was recently on in KPFA Los Angeles, which is a node and a center for monarchist and MEK supporters, so I'm sure he's even taking more flack than he was. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared Remember PacificaNetwork.org? They're covering demonstrations across the country, and there'll be a call in from here, from Cope Cumston, local producer, as well. Thanks for supporting community media. Thanks to our matching friend. This is Match Madness. Doesn't resonate for me because I'm not really a college basketball fan that much. It's even gotten worse with the new pay-to-play system, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah.